Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Adam Mendelsohn, who teaches at the University of Cape Town, here to talk about his new book, The Rag Race, How Jews Sowed Their Way to Success in America and the British Empire, published in 2015 by New York University Press. Adam, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Jason, thank you for inviting me on.
Well, it's great to have you. I should note you're calling from South Africa. Thank you. So, Adam, the book begins with a question that I always get, which is, why have Jews been so economically successful in the United States? So maybe you can tell us about some of the leading explanations, why you thought they were insufficient, and why you wrote the book in order to address the question.
Thanks. Very good question. So I've always been struck by this phenomena, which I think many of us are familiar with, of outsized Jewish success, or seemingly disproportionate Jewish success in a whole range of arenas, you know, whether it's in the law, this disproportionate, with this extraordinary number of Jews in the Supreme Court, you know, at the moment, three and maybe soon to be four Jews on the court, in Hollywood, Wall Street, and in all sorts of very prominent areas of American life, we see, you know, Jews extremely well represented. I mean, for a population which makes up just, you know, maybe 2% of the total population, this is clearly outsized success in a variety of ways. And something which I've been interested in, as I said, it clearly is a broader phenomenon at work here. And I began to wonder about, you know, how have sociologists and historians actually explained this? And what I discovered is that it is a subject which hasn't received as much attention as you'd expect for all sorts of reasons, which I think, you know, relatively predictable that talking about success can be uncomfortable. There's a concern that it might raise anti-Semitism. All sorts of reasons why it hasn't been studied perhaps as much as it should have. What I discovered as well is that raw Jewish success can be broken down, at least the existing literature on Jewish success, such as it is, can be broken down into a number of different categories. In its most crude form, there are those who argue that there is something almost genetic about Jewish success that's sort of in the blood or in the genes, but which is really a sort of relatively marginal line of argumentation. But more serious argumentation, I think the dominant mode of argument is that there's something special about Jewish culture that, and this is quite a sort of a broad category of explanation, everything from an argument that, you know, Jews have a high rate of literacy, that they send their children to university in high numbers, to that sort of one line of argument, it's sort of an educational argument, to other sort of cultural arguments, suggestion that perhaps Jews have been programmed by their history of marginalization and exclusion to be, you know, to think like outsiders, or even perhaps a sort of a variation of that argument, that Jews have been economically marginalized, and particularly in the Middle Ages, and that that trained them to think in particular ways that other groups did not, perhaps develop a sense of transmittable business acumen between generations. Jews were more flexible, perhaps. Now, there's a whole range of arguments of this kind. In essence, as I said, sort of a broad, what I describe as sort of cultural arguments. I think those are the arguments which have really dominated, thinking about it. And we see it, you know, reflected in popular literature as well, that you know, the books like The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother make this sort of argument that, in essence, you know, there's something special about Jewish culture. And I thought, okay, there might be something to that. There might be some sort of proclivities, perhaps towards literacy, towards education, things of that kind. And perhaps some of these played a role within the immigrant generations. We do know, for example, that Jews had higher rates of literacy than many other immigrant groups to America in the 19th and early 20th century. We also know that immigrants, for example, also came from a culture where, yes, there was a greater ease with money and a greater ease with the market than, for example, peasants coming from southern Italy or elsewhere. But I thought, you know, those explanations are appealing, but let's interrogate them properly. And that's really the genesis of this book, that I developed this, drawing on really the research of others, but developed this comparison with, I thought about immigrants, Jewish immigrants coming from the same place, in this case, coming from, you know, the same shtetls in Eastern Europe, the same cities in Eastern Europe, making their way to America and England. And let's compare the trajectory of Jews in both societies, because these are the Jews with the same cultural baggage. Therefore, they should perform in the same way. And yet what I discovered is they don't perform in the same way, at least in economic terms, in their host society. So the question I raised for me is that, okay, culture is not enough. There must be other explanations here that we need to think about. So it's really, my book is a way to test, to present a really a theory, an alternative theory of Jewish economic success, one which does not discount cultural factors, but says there are other things at work here. And basically what I suggest are structural factors, are sort of historical and contingent factors, which must be accounted for to explain why Jews have done so well.
Mm-hmm. So you can test Jews against other immigrant groups, and you can also test Jews in the U.S. and then in England and the Empire. So sort of two case studies or control groups. Tell us about what happened sort of in the early 1880s and why your book is sort of a preamble to that story.
Mm. So you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that's a very good description of it, that most work on the clothing industry, the Jews in the clothing industry, really begins in the 1880s and deals with the Lower East Side and might deal with other major centers in America, you know, Chicago, elsewhere, but doesn't really focus much attention on that prehistory, on everything which comes before the 1880s. And in essence, my argument here is that to understand, the concentration of Jews in the clothing trade, and then also patterns of development within the clothing trade for Jews, we need to understand how Jews have become involved in this business much earlier. And so in essence, I argue that in both places, both in America and in England, there are these older patterns of Jewish involvement in this business. And in particular, that these older patterns of involvement create particular opportunities for the future immigrants. So in the case of America, there's a broad distribution network which has been created by an earlier generation of particularly Central European and German-speaking immigrants, and which plays to the advantage in a way of later Eastern European Jews. So in other words, this is a structural factor at work. In the case in England, there certainly is a much earlier and potential Jewish involvement in the clothing business, but it presents, again, because of historical accent, a different set of pressures and opportunities for Eastern European Jews when they arrive. But in essence, my argument, again, to summarize it very simply, is that in America, because of all sorts of historical accidents, there are all sorts of opportunities for Eastern European Jews to get into the clothing trade in the 1880s, but crucially, there are all sorts of ways for them to get out of the business. And for Jews in England, there are also plenty of points of access to the business, and Jews in both societies, both England and America, this will be by far the dominant immigrant occupation in both places. But so there are also plenty of ways in, but there are many fewer ways out because of historical reasons. So more Jews remain concentrated in the clothing trade in England for far longer, with all sorts of long-term consequences, I argue, in England compared with America, where Jews get out more quickly.
There are some interesting historical accidents, which I hope we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But just to keep in mind, nothing was preordained. It's not as if the American clothing industry was set to surpass the British one, which I hope we'll get to. But I want to ask you just basically, what is the rag trade? Maybe you can just tell us briefly about, you know, it's hard to imagine because now we just go to a store and or order online. What exactly was the clothing trade and how did it work?
So the rag trade is different from how we think about it today. But today we think our experience is we go to a clothing store, and there's a profusion of ready-made clothing available in multiple sizes, and it's relatively inexpensive, certainly affordable for most of us. That's not what clothing is like for most people at the beginning of the 19th century, certainly for many people in London and New York during those sort of early decades of the century. Instead, clothing is expensive. There is some ready-made clothing available, but much of it is rough and relatively crude. And if you want decent ready-made clothing, if you want decent clothing, it's going to be either tailored, which is expensive, which is time-consuming, which involves expert tailors, or alternatively, it's going to be bought secondhand from a variety of stores and markets in either London or New York. And it's that business in particular, the secondhand trade, that Jews in both cities have become very involved with. It's a business which is, as I said, far broader and more popular than secondhand clothing is today, because it fills this vital market position that most people can't afford new tailored clothing, so therefore the secondhand markets fill the gap. And Jews are involved in everything from the real underside of that business, really sort of marginal secondhand clothing, things which have been repaired multiple times and sort of stitched together, to somewhat finer secondhand clothing. And they are involved in all levels of the business in other sense as well, but everything from collecting this clothing from people who are trying to get rid of it or trying to barter it, to the distribution of it, to consumers, to the sale of it in markets, et cetera, et cetera. So the Jews are very active in this in the secondhand trade in a variety of ways. They aren't pioneers, however, in the ready-made trade at all. In fact, the Jews come late to the business of manufacturing ready-made clothing, and part of my book describes how this process unfolds, how they manage to move from a relatively unsavory occupation, a secondhand trading, to dominating parts of the ready-made trade.
So chapter one of the book begins with sort of a panoramic view of London in 1843. What would we have seen if we were sort of standing there? And then chapter two looks at New York around the same time. And you've touched on this. There was already a difference between the two cities at that point. But tell us what we need to know about the trade in New York and in London in the early 1840s.
So in both cities, there's a vibrant market in secondhand goods, and particularly in secondhand clothing, because obviously everyone needs clothing. And there is often, actually in both places, plenty of secondhand clothing in circulation, being collected and resold, repaired, etc. But the market in London is much more sophisticated than that in New York, that in part it's because of the scale of the British Empire, that secondhand clothing has been collected in London and shipped off to places like Australia, but also because this market has been in existence for much, much longer, that the Jews are not the pioneers again of the secondhand clothing trade in England. Instead, they really take over elements of this trade from others who've been involved in it for centuries beforehand. There's an existing system in place, but one which is going to grow dramatically as the British Empire itself grows. Equally, the market in London is supplying not just the empire with secondhand clothing, but also is supplying places like Ireland, shipping clothing to the Caribbean, to South America, and elsewhere. There's also a vibrant secondhand market in Chatham Street in New York and a variety of other cities in America at the time, but nothing of the scale that we see in London. And for a whole variety of reasons, that certainly there seems to be indications there's less clothing to go around. Equally, there isn't yet elaborate mechanism for distributing clothing into, you know, the American frontier or elsewhere. Jews are going to be involved in very much in those processes, in part because the market in New York is that much more limited. It means that there isn't as much of an ethnic home for Jews seeking out opportunity in New York. In other words, they are in London. You can sort of spend your entire career involved in one or other dimension of the secondhand trade. In New York, there are fewer opportunities, and therefore, for that and other reasons, many more Central European Jewish immigrants who make their way to America in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s are going to strike their way out west, and they'll certainly be involved in distributing clothing and selling clothing as peddlers, but it's a somewhat different occupation than we see particularly in London, for example.
What happens in the sort of two decades, in the 1850s and then just up until the 1860, there seems to be some changes in the dynamics. You talk about, technology changes, market changes, advertising changes. Tell us what's going on in terms of the two cities competing.
Certainly, I mean, these are, as you point out, these are key decades. And we see some significant changes, particularly in London, as with the growth of Australia in particular, sort of gold rush in sort of the 1850s in Australia, which draws significant numbers of people to migrate there, but also produces a boom for those who are able to sell goods, to export goods in particular to this, you know, the thriving market. And we see a number of Jewish families who are involved in both the second-hand trade and are beginning to enter into the ready-made clothing trade as well, beginning to branch out and send relatives, for example, to open up stores or to ship clothing to Australia. So there's almost a breakthrough of Jews in London into ready-made manufacturing. And again, certain amount of innovation, particularly in advertising and in producing what really are proto department stores for customers in London in particular. So people who are, you know, finding ways to mass manufacture clothing and sell it to customers who previously had bought a secondhand clothing. So there's definitely major change afoot for Jews in London involved in the secondhand trade. And the same sort of thing going on, similar sort of things going on in terms of at least change in the United States, where in the 1850s, there is, by this point in time, Jews have settled in a number of small towns across the West and across the South, but a very different process of moving upward in the clothing business that we see Jews struggle more to break into the front ranks of the clothing business in New York, but more success beginning to develop in places like Cincinnati in particular, which is booming at this point in town. And there it's Jews are moving up in part because of this distribution network, which has been established by Jewish peddlers who've opened up stores in small towns across the West and in parts of the South, that they are a natural distribution system for this incipient class of Jewish clothing manufacturers. So Jews are beginning to break in both places, but it looks far less promising in a variety of ways for Jews in America. In America, the older pioneers of the ready-made clothing business are still dominant, and that Jews are very much secondary there. That looks like it looks unlikely that the Jews will you know, play leading roles, except perhaps for a few exceptions, within the clothing business. In England, by contrast, Jews are there are a few more Jewish pioneers, as I said, who are experimenting with advertising, experimenting with these grand emporia in the East End of London and elsewhere. And so it looks like Jews in England have now well ahead of those in the United States.
Right. And then one of the historical accidents that you talk about, what happens in the 1860s that allows the Jews in the clothing trade in the United States to really take off?
It's certainly very much connected with the Civil War. And again, it's not in quite the way that we would imagine. For a variety of reasons, Jewish business people in the 1850s in New York and Cincinnati haven't been able to muscle to the front of the most lucrative market for clothing in America at that time. And this is not the what you might imagine. It's not the market in the Northeast. Instead, it's the Southern market, which is very much made rich during the 1840s and 1850s by a spike in the price of cotton. It means that Southern plantation owners and merchants and others have money to spend, and they spend a lot of this money importing clothing and other luxury goods. But because Jews aren't at the forefront of the clothing trade, because they're not the most fashionable producers of clothing, they're relatively unsuccessful in that market. Certainly, many better-known firms at that time, non-Jewish firms at the time, really dominate the Southern trade. Instead, Jews are forced, New York Jews and Cincinnati Jews are forced to look elsewhere for markets, for new markets. And one of those markets, which is an extremely risky market at the time, is out west, in particularly in San Francisco after the gold rush. And we see that's where Jews begin to establish a beachhead and ultimately establish sort of a firm footing in this California market. It's a far more risky market than is the South. There are, in San Francisco, there are multiple bankruptcies of Jewish clothing firms, and you know, Jewish clothiers who send siblings or cousins or other to establish branches of the family firm in San Francisco. The failure in many ways is more common than success. But this accident, in a way, of being focused in San Francisco, focused in California, and not in the South, turns out to be an enormous stroke of good fortune when the Civil War starts, because all those clothing firms, New York clothing firms, which have invested their fortunes and their futures in the Southern trade and have assumed for decades that this is where they'll make their largest profits, many of them suddenly discover that they not only have they lost their markets, but they've lost a huge amount of money as their Southern merchants, their Southern retailers and others refuse to pay their debts. So they are crippled by at least the beginning of the Civil War, when the march to war begins. Whereas those who invested in California, by contrast, these Jewish firms, by accident, that's where they've sought their fortune, they do extremely well. That's in part because of the relative price of gold and other such things. So they were very well positioned during these sort of terrible months before the beginning of the war, when there's an economic crisis in America. California firms do much better than those in the South. So again, it's just an accident of positioning works to the favor of these Jewish firms. It means that when the Civil War, when the enormous orders which are going to be placed by the Union Army start rolling through, it means that these Jewish firms are well positioned to take advantage of that. And likewise, through the war, it helps to have access to gold from California and things like this. So it's again, it flips the script in a way. The Civil War, and it means that these Jewish firms go from being secondary within this business to suddenly being in the pound seats.
Mm-hmm. Which sort of leads us to where we started, which is in the early 1880s, we see the beginning of the flood of millions of Eastern European Jews. Although your story is not as simple as, those immigrants were tailors in Eastern Europe, and so they came to the United States and they found a home, in the clothing business. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and I think maybe a key theme is entrepreneurialism. So maybe you can tell us how the story that we've just talked about sort of set the table for the 1880s.
Good question. So, and this is in fact one of these areas where we see this divergence between England and particularly London and America, particularly New York. So in the American case, by the 1880s, Jews are very involved by this point in time in ready-made manufacturing of all sorts of types of clothing, particularly in New York, but in a number of other places as well. And crucially, they've done this through creating this distribution system that they're still Jews in small towns all over the West and elsewhere, who act as retailers for Jewish manufacturers. And there is a, it's very much, as I described, an entrepreneurial model, one where, you know, these an earlier generation of peddlers set themselves up in business, and not all prosper by any means, but many have becoming the, you know, linchpins of small towns, the traders who have access to credit and goods from larger cities. By contrast, in England, Jews haven't been pushed ahead in quite the same sort of way. Instead, far more Jews remain involved in the secondhand clothing trade, which far fewer have broken into to mass manufacturing of clothing. And there never was anything of a distribution system outside of London of the scale that we see for Jews in New York and Cincinnati. It's known that Jews haven't become peddlers in England on the same scale that they have in the United States. And this means that when these hundreds of thousands of Eastern European Jewish immigrants begin to arrive in the 1880s and 1890s, they're going to be funneled into the clothing trade, not because they necessarily have tailoring skills. In fact, as other historians have demonstrated, many of these immigrants, in fact, come very ill-prepared for work in a modern industrial economy. And so this is work which is relatively unskilled. This is work which is poorly paid, which is unpleasant. It's not work you necessarily want to a field of work you want to remain in for very long. But Jews are going to, this is going to become the dominant occupation for hundreds of thousands of Jewish immigrants. But in the case of the United States, there are avenues out of this trade, and in fact, it's impetus to leave the trade behind. And here we're entering into sort of a complicated additional subject, which I can talk about in a moment. In England, for a variety of reasons, in part because there aren't obvious avenues out of the business, there's no prior entrepreneurial model to draw on, but for other reasons as well, Jews are going to remain in this business far longer. So in fact, much of my argument for Jewish success in the 20th century, or the comparative success of Jews in America relative to those of Jews in England, comes back to this question of what opportunities are there for Jews outside of the clothing trade, and how much impetus is there to leave the clothing trade behind? In essence, I argue that the Jews in New York and Chicago and elsewhere, you want to leave the clothing trade behind as quickly as you can, and many Jews do. In England, where there are fewer entrepreneurial models and the clothing trade is more attractive for a variety of reasons, more Jews stay, and that's going to have repercussions over the long term.
Well, Adam, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
So something completely different. I'm working on a project about a very odd encounter between a group of missionaries who are in northern Ethiopia in the 1860s aiming to convert the Falasha, encounter between them and a Ethiopian emperor who's eager to take them, to kidnap them, which he ultimately does, and the soldiers from India who are sent to rescue them, many of whom turn out to be Jewish as well. So it's a very strange meeting between missionaries, Falasha, and the Indian Jewish soldiers who come to rescue them. So it's a very odd encounter, which I'll use to tell a broader story about this particular moment in time.
That is different. That sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is The Rag Race, How Jews Sowed Their Way to Success in America and the British Empire, published in 2015 by New York University Press. The author's Adam Mendelsohn. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.